Dear Mr. Secretary, more than 2 years ago, I assumed the duties of Chief of Staff. The United States Army was then embarked on a mass demobilization whose speed and magnitude expressed the American people's assumption that an enduring peace had been attained.
Welcome home, G.I.s! Welcome home, G.I.s!
Look at that skyline! Home! Ain't it pretty? Peace, it's wonderful!
Welcome home, G.I.s! Welcome home!
But the tragedy of this era is that the din of war ended, only to be replaced by a clash of ideologies. True cooperation among the powers, the only sure basis for peace, has yet to be proved workable.
Living 1948, brought to you each week by NBC and its affiliates, holds up its radio mirror as we approach Army Day to reflect the answer to the increasingly important question, how secure are we? In our sixth drama document entitled,
From a Gentleman in Mufti.
Here is your narrator, Ben Grauer.
Greetings, America. A few weeks ago, a man we all know put aside his army uniform, donned a civilian suit and a black Homburg hat, paused to let his wife adjust his tie, and stepped into private life. The man, of course, was the smiling soldier who led us to victory in the European theater of World War II, Dwight D. Eisenhower. But before he left as Army Chief of Staff, General Eisenhower prepared a sort of valedictory entitled
Final Report of the Chief of Staff, United States Army, to the Secretary of the Army.
Because of the critical nature of these times, we've reclaimed that report, and we propose, with the help of actors and music, to put it to dramatization. The words you hear will be Eisenhower's, spoken by Art Carney. The asides, dramatic and otherwise, our own. With perhaps the destiny of the world hanging upon what you do about these facts, we give you now the gist of what might have been called General Eisenhower's five-star final, his final report.
I believe that we have learned that national defense is not the exclusive property and concern of men in uniform, but the responsibility as well of every group that goes to make up the national complex. I have heard it said that in 1948, major security projects have a slight chance of passage because...
Listen, this is an election year. Wise up. Don't expect anybody to do anything about anything in an election year.
But our position of 5, 10, 15 years hence is being determined now. Despite scaremongers, the United States is still first among nations in wealth, production, technical achievement, and the skill of her citizens. Emotional fear must not be permitted to sway the national judgment.
I don't think we should do the slightest thing that would make any other nation think we'll go to war. Not a thing. Not a thing.
Blindness so induced would be a peril as great as any physical menace. Neither is there any sound reason for Americans to despair of peace, nor to be swept into panic by threatening events of the day.
What are we waiting for? If we're going to have war, I say beat them to the punch.
In the world situation, there are weighty credits for continued peace. On the other hand, there are debits. Let us realistically appraise all the elements that affect America's peace to determine what measure security now requires.
The credits for continued peace.
On the credit side, our unique industrial economy, a major factor in the Allied victory, is stronger than ever before. Foremost among technical advances, we have achieved atomic fission.
From Army Talk number 138, page 3.
It is hard to believe that two nations, only one of which had atomic bombs, would ever go to war. The nation with no atomic bombs would only invite the complete destruction of its cities and factories. and would have no means of retaliation.
Alone among the industrial powers, our production plant suffered no physical damage during World War II.
How, Joe? How's everything in your division?
No complaints, Mort. Look at the stuff roll out. You ever see production like that before?
I guess that know-how we learned during the war is paying off, eh?
Oh, brother, I'll say it is.
In a test of material strength by war, the advantage during the immediate future would probably lie with the United States. Such recognition would seem to lessen the danger of deliberate attack on us. We are joined, furthermore, with all the major powers in a cooperative effort beyond precedent in breadth and possibilities.
Well, I think we get the thing settled once and for all, don't you?
This session of the United Nations Assembly will come to order.
In addition, our late enemies are prostrate.
After 6 years of the most destructive war in history, 2 years of paralyzing post-war exhaustion and chaos, the compelling thought of most people is,
will we ever have enough to eat again?
It is difficult to see their revival as dangerous aggressions within this generation. Our stout ties of common basic purpose with the British Commonwealth and with the democracies of Western Europe weigh heavily as a stabilizing influence. Since we share with them the same fundamental attitudes of men living together in a peaceful world, a challenge to the existence of one should be recognized as a challenge to all.
It has been and is. Remember the date.
March 17, 1948.
The event?
West Europe Treaty, signed by five nations.
The action?
Britain, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg today bound their 107 million people to fight as a unit against any aggressor by signing a 50-year treaty reading,
if any of the high contracting parties should be the object of armed attack in Europe,
the other high contracting parties will
afford the parties so attacked all military and other aid and assistance in their power.
To fortify our position further, the United States is maintaining the largest professional military establishment in our peacetime history. These are the credits in our security position. Taken singly, each of them contributes toward world stability and against the return of war. Taken as a sum, we hope they will assure continued peace. Nevertheless, there is no real assurance of peace. Our present security measures are inadequate. And unless remedial steps are taken, the Army with its civilian components may, in crisis, prove too weak for its defense mission.
The debits against continued peace.
The first step in resolving this seeming contradiction is to appreciate that the dollars currently allotted to the Army are not military dollars, pure and simple.
It's like having a mitt full of money, friends, to use to defend yourself. Then you say, well, let me see. I got to spend some over here to occupy Germany.
Thank you.
And some over here to occupy Japan.
Thank you.
Then, all of a sudden, you wake up and discover,
Where's the dough you need to construct defenses and increase our war potential?
Gosh, sorry. You'll just have to take what's left.
Chicken feed.
The purely security mission, organizing, training, and sharpening for defense, has necessarily taken second place. By no stretch of the facts can the United States Army, as it is now manned, deployed, and engaged, be considered an offensive force. It is not ready to respond to an emergency call because its global distribution,
the equivalent of 10 divisions, 2 in Korea, 4 in Japan, 2 1/3 at home, 1+ in Germany, and so on,
not only leaves it weak in every sector, but prevents the concentration of anything beyond the merest handful for possible tactical use. Also, political unrest, social turbulence, and economic distress are today more marked and more widespread than at any previous time in our generation.
From Time Magazine, a summary. Czechoslovakia, under. The Finns, ready to bow. In Greece, communists winning. In Italy, communists and friends, a good chance to win the April 18th elections. In France, last year's decline of communist strength stopped.
Conditions today are sufficiently turbulent that war might be visited upon the world without the impetus of planning or deliberate policy. One isolated action might precipitate, and once started in a critical area, war leaps across new borders and quickly involves other nations whose desire is for peace. Our future security depends on American willingness to combat unceasingly the conditions that provoke war.
In a recent appearance before a joint session of Congress, these words from President Truman.
The time has come when the free men and women of the world must face the threat to their liberties squarely and courageously. We must be prepared to pay the price of peace, or assuredly, we shall pay the price of war.
The road to genuine security is to work for peace, but that is a long-term program. In the meantime, it is vital to our security interests that we consider
the short-term security program.
We daily become sensitive to types of attacks that will certainly be characteristic of future wars. Many millions of urban dwellers who raise none of their own food would starve within weeks if the transport system were broken.
But we've been trading at his grocery for years.
He says he can't help it. With the trains not running, he can't get any stock.
Heavy industry would shut down if...
Pittsburgh, Gary, Birmingham, all destroyed. How are we going to make guns and planes if we can't get steel?
Our national life would be crippled if by sudden attack...
Yes, sir?
Can't you get through to Washington?
No, sir.
New York?
No, sir.
Chicago?
No, sir. It just can't be done. It's these sudden attacks.
To contemplate such possibilities is pessimism at its blackest. But they remain possibilities which we must weigh calmly. Fortunately, no enemy has the capacity now to wage war aimed at our total defeat. None can develop it faster in the future than we can increase our defensive capacity. Consequently, an adequate short-term security program is assurance of a safe position within which we can continue to support the long-term program of total or world security.
Outlining this short-term security program, General Eisenhower pointed out,
because major nations in the future will be armed with weapons of terrifying destructive power, a series of lightning blows might conceivably end a future war at its outset. A corollary to this
is... It would, he said, be necessary to have a system of major and alternate bases around which can be organized first our defense and next our retaliatory counteroffensive. As for the atom bomb...
At this point, there appears to be no positive defense against the atomic bomb once it is released in the target area.
But he also declared that, like any other weapon, certain factors inherent in its use limit its effectiveness.
I can tell you one of them, the numbers of the bomb. Anybody would need a mighty big stockpile to knock out our war potential, or anybody else's for that matter.
Not only that, the distance from the base to your target. Each mile added to its flight cuts down on the accuracy of your projectile.
And don't forget, you've got to move your bombs by land, air, or sea, and no plane or ship is immune long to counteraction.
He then said, if initial blows against the enemy fail to bring peace,
the military establishment must be prepared to concentrate against the enemy all our resources, physical and psychological. A continuous series of attacks, highly diversified in character, would be launched at key points whose destruction or denial to the enemy would quickly cause his collapse. The short-term security program, consequently, must be governmental, military, and industrial in nature. After calling for legislation on the books to be ready for use in an emergency, industrial preparedness, and federal direction of civil defense, the general then launched into
military aspects.
Many voice the opinion today that goes,
foot soldiers in the next war? Where you been, brother? With rockets and atom bombs, the foot soldiers gone the way of the bow and arrow.
Today, the only element of the military establishment that can hold a defensive position, seize for exploitation a major offensive base, exercise direct, complete control over an enemy population, three fundamental purposes of armed effort, is, as always, the foot soldier.
Junior, did you hear what the man said?
The introduction of the plane and the atomic bomb has no more eliminated the need for him than did the first use of cavalry or the discovery of gunpowder. To grasp the initiative,
he pointed to the need for a highly mobile striking force backed by organized civilian components for the training of first-class leaders and men, and then,
generally speaking, another war would be fought with weapons developed before its onset. We must do everything possible now to assure ourselves that we will fight another war with weapons more advanced than those of our enemies.
Steam. Dry ice. Wind.
You're at the Army's Climate Laboratory at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, watching a test being made of a 75-millimeter winterized howitzer.
Okay, test.
In a room 40 degrees below zero, a four-man crew breaks position, struggles to tug at the breech of a non-winterized howitzer. But with the winterized howitzer, with its newly developed lubricants, it's...
Breech, charge, lanyard, fire!
Other items developed and already tested must be placed in production now if they are to be ready for a future D-Day force. The present supply is not enough. Unless this defect is remedied, we will shortly have to acknowledge that in weapons and equipment, our ground troops may prove inferior to a modern offensive force. The best of equipment, unit organization, and operational plans are worthless without trained manpower. In the face of nationwide full employment.
Listen to what it says here.
Hmm?
130,000 short for the Army. And with a world situation like it is.
Short of what, dear?
Soldiers.
Oh.
Short of our authorized Army strength. Too many good jobs around.
Well, I can understand why they're trying to give the WAC permanent status. After all, that would help some.
What constitutes readiness for the United States Army has been the subject of intensive staff study. One firm conclusion reached is...
Here you are, sir. I think there are enough copies here for everybody.
Yeah, thanks, Corporal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, General.
Thank you.
General.
Thank you. All right, let's hear it now. Let's see how it goes.
On M-Day of a war with a major power, we shall need a minimum ground force of 1,300,000 men.
Yeah, not right. One division
left. Organized, trained, and equipped to hold the bases and areas on which depend both the defense of America and the mounting of a counteroffense.
Well, with Russia maintaining millions under arms, I'll buy that.
Yes, I agree with you.
Maintenance of a regular army at this figure would be prohibitively expensive. One feasible solution is to build the National Guard and organize reserves to their required M-Day strength. They will be needed at those strengths, not a year or two after war starts, but on the first day of hostilities.
There is much more we lack the time to describe that General Eisenhower made clear in his final report as Chief of Staff. A report that means even more today than it did a few weeks ago. He called for universal military training, unification of the defense establishment in which the Joint Chiefs of Staff have recently reached general accord,
implementation of a long-term security program. But near the end, he put the responsibility for our security where it belongs in a democracy.
It is up to the American people. A security establishment that will guarantee the continuance of a free America and the increase of our influence for freedom and peace throughout the world cannot be achieved through legislation alone unless it is willed by the United States, by the counties and communities, by the men and women of the United States, determined to retain their liberties and to stand firm against aggression.
Question then, what about the American people?
I think I can answer that, Mr. Grauer.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, this is William Lydgate, editor of the Gallup poll that you read in your newspapers. What can you tell us, Mr. Lydgate, about the mood of the public in these days of world tension?
Beyond any doubt, Ben, the public is ready and willing to support the immediate strengthening of the nation's military forces.
How do you know?
The way we always know. We ask them, and just as bluntly as this.
Do you think the United States should increase the size of its army?
61% said...
Yes, sir.
Navy?
63% said...
You bet. Air Force?
74% answered that.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, American voters have been overwhelmingly in favor of stronger armed forces ever since 1935, when we asked exactly this same question in one of our very first surveys. The public has consistently given its approval before its representatives acted.
Would we as a people be willing to pay more taxes to support an Army, Navy, and Air Force?
Well, sir, we wondered about that, too.
So?
We asked them. The majority, averaging over 55%, said in effect...
Count me in.
What about the veterans, Mr. Lydgate? How do they feel about all this?
More strongly than the non-veterans, believe it or not. Perhaps they look at it this way.
Listen, I've been through it once before. Maybe if we show them we mean business, I won't have to go through it again.
Now let's get to two of the important recommendations made by President Truman in his recent address before Congress. The President said, remember...
The adoption of universal military training by the United States at this time would be unmistakable evidence to the world of our determination to back the will to peace with the strength for peace.
Does the public agree with him, Mr. Lydgate?
Emphatically, Ben, as they always have on this subject of military training. Our latest poll, taken just in time to be heard on Living 1948, shows 7 out of 10 who believe...
Every able-bodied young man ought to be required to take military or naval training for at least a year.
One more question, Mr. Lydgate.
Yes, Ben?
How about the draft?
On selective service, 6 out of every 10 questioned answered in effect...
What's needed is needed. I'm ready for it.
It makes sense.
Thanks, Mr. Lydgate. And now, back to the words of the gentleman in mufti.
The American people possess the capacity, the initiative, and the resolution to maintain this nation a leader among nations, strong in its moral position, its physical defenses, its economic wealth, and its productiveness for human betterment. Then the counsel and example of the United States will be the world's most potent influence toward increase of freedom and peace among men, the final security goal of mankind.
Living 1948 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by an NBC public affairs staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold, with scripts written by Lou Hazem, technical advice by Jane Tiffany Wagner, music conducted by Milton Katum. Art Carney played Eisenhower, and your narrator was Ben Grauer. The program was directed by James Harvey. We invite you to keep abreast of Living 1948 by joining us next Sunday when we'll present a drama document entitled
As Europe Sees Us.
This program came to you from our Radio City studios in New York. Robert Warren speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.